Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. So, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies and promoting our speaker's book, I Object. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference, brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremedyisinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions and all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded, yet years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Everett for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not that your remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over at this time to Mr. Edward, and he will introduce our speaker for this evening.
Well, thank you very much, Martin. I appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to once again delve into the reality of working through an alter ego. No, that's not the right word. Another entity that in which you operate completely anonymously. And that entity is referred to as an LLC. Now, all the LLCs that you're familiar with, they're crafted, wrought in such a way that they follow the advice of attorneys or CPAs whose curriculum that they were taught their trade through guided them a certain way that made your LLC liable for taxes. Tonight you're going to hear from Mr. Slevin how this unique arrangement of how this LLC is formulated creates a non-taxable entity and is easily used as a replacement to you as an employee directly with the company you work for, rather than you can work be a worker for the LLC that the company you used to work for hired in place of this arrangement. You still show up for work, but you show up for work as a worker for the LLC. And of course, as well, for entrepreneurs that operate their business, their commercial business, there's a way to translate the arrangement that you currently operate through, whatever that organization may be, and supplant it with this LLC. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin. Go ahead, buddy.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There is a large question in America today. It is, am I liable for the income tax? Well, how do you find that out? It's really hard. Now, everybody tells you you are, but hey, let's look at it a different way. Find out who is not liable and join them. From Title 26, United States Code, Chapter 1, Normal Taxes and Surtaxes, Section 701, quote, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed by this chapter, period. Persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for income tax only in their separate or individual capacities, end quote. Now, the guys that write this stuff, use what's called the rules of statutory construction. And there's a couple of them that we want to look at real quick. First of all, in the rules, if a word or phrase is defined as a term, then only the definition of said term can be used when applying the statute. And the other one is, if you define a word or phrase as a term, then only what is in the list can be used as that term. Makes sense, right? No, it doesn't, but hey, that's the way they do things. So let's go to the definition section. So 7701A, and it says, when used in this title, we're not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly incompatible with the intent thereof, one person. The term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company, or corporation. Now, we saw the term person used in the second sentence of 7701. Now, this word individual, you notice it doesn't really seem to fall in with the other lists like the trust, estate, partnership, association, and so forth. So it's, you know, and it's a delimiter. I mean, it means one of something, right? Well, one of what? A spotted lizard, a corporate officer, a one-eyed jack. Or could it be the term individual is defined in Black's Law, 6th edition, and that is, quote, existing as an indivisible entity. Now, that would make more sense, right? That would be an indivisible entity, a trust, a state, partnership, association, company, or corporation. Makes sense, right? No. And number two, we find the term partnership. In part, it reads an unincorporated organization. Well, the, you know, there's two particular, there's three forms of business traditionally. The first are the corporation and the partnership, which go back millennia. Corporations are almost always chartered by some government or some government entity or monarchy. The partnership was typically a personal agreement between two or more people and to do business under that name. Well, in 1977, they brought these two together, and the formation of that legislation was called a limited liability company, which they changed the verbiage around. So in corporations, you have officers like CEO, president, whatever you want to call them, and it's owned by shareholders. So the number of shares that the people have give them voting rights within the corporation and to choose the officers. In partnerships, you have general partners and limited partners. And in LLCs, you have only one officer, which is a manager. And then you have percentages of membership rather than shares. But you can have as many managers as you wish, and you can have the membership down to like four or five decimals. You know, you don't just have 100% member. You can have it down to, you know, 10,000 or 100,000 individual membership certificates. Before we leave the definition section, in A20 we find this really interesting thing. It's called employee. The term, and it starts off, and there's about 100 words before it gets down to the meat, and it says the term employee shall include a full-time life insurance salesman. Now, who is considered an employee for the purposes of Chapter 21? So just in case you thought you were an employee, you can go look at that and find out that unless you're a full-time life insurance salesman or a corporate officer, you're not an employee, according to the code. So now we know who is not subject to the income tax. That would be the limited liability company. So all business done under that is not subject to the income tax. Well, how do we get one of those? Our company was, our company goes out and we canvas out and clients contact us and we give them an application to purchase and then they fill that out and we come upon a name and they pay the fee. And then we take our people, and one of our people goes down to the Secretary of State of New Mexico. Now, why New Mexico? Well, I'm about to tell you. The Secretary of State of New Mexico, and they put in an application. This is called the Articles of Organization. Now, these Articles of Organization require a minimum of two parties. And those, the titles of those parties are Organizer, which is the one doing the organizing, and Registered Agent. Now, the great thing about New Mexico is both of those parties can be other LLCs. So think about that for a minute. You have one LLC that owns the other LLC, that owns the other LLC, et cetera, on the public record. Well, gee, that sounds like a little bit of privacy built in there. Now, of course, you've probably heard of places like Delaware, Nevada, possibly Wyoming, who are supposed to be the, you know, the place to incorporate and or organize. Again, incorporate is incorporations. And organizing is limited liability companies or partnerships. So even though Delaware, Nevada, so on, are very protective, they still require people's names on their application. And that is known as a nominee list, and they protect this list. In New Mexico, there doesn't, it doesn't have a list, and you can't find what is not, does not exist. So once that, applications approved by the Secretary of State of New Mexico, he or she issues a certificate of organization for the new company. Here again shows you the difference between incorporation, which gets articles of incorporation, and the certificate of organization. So then one of our workers who has never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return and is therefore without the jurisdiction of the IRS goes to its website and files a tax identification number for a tax identification number known as an employer identification number or EIN. And there are a number of questions when one goes and applies for an EIN. And the questions read, this question reads, why is the LLC requesting an EIN? And there's about five answers, and we always choose this one. It's for banking purposes, and the subheading goes, select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or local law. Do you hear anything about taxes in there? No, because they know that the limited liability company is not subject to the income tax because it falls under the term partnership. Used in section 701. So when the EIN is then issued by the IRS to the new limited liability company and they bring it back to the office and at that time the petitioner of the IRS for the new EIN is known as the sole member on their documents. And that sole member holds a meeting of the members, and in that meeting they do a resolution and they appoint a manager, which happens to be another of our personnel. As I said, managers are the only officer of limited liability companies. So would the then they hand off those three pieces of paper, the certificate, the EIN paperwork, which is also known as the CP-575, Space G, and the resolution, and then that, which is also known as a letter of authority, to the manager, the newly commissioned manager, and he takes it on down to a brick and mortar bank and gets this brand new company a checking account with a debit card and electronic banking and all the bells and whistles that normally go with today's endeavor. Then they bring all that back to the office. One of our other people programs up a pay-as-you-go cell phone. Here again, all about anonymity and privacy. The phone is loaded up with electronic banking from the brick and mortar bank, as well as a Square app and Cash app. Now, Square is a point of sale app, and Cash app is a peer-to-peer platform that where you can move money back and forth really quick and easy. It'll require that the client set these up once they get them. But once you, Square and Cash App now both offer business checking accounts and debit cards. So once all this is fleshed out, then the company would have three separate checking accounts and three debit cards to access, and all those intertwine. So you have not, you know, you always want to have a backup. As we used to say in the military, which I spent quite a bit of time in, one is none and two is one. So always want to have backup. So using Cash, Square, and the brick and mortar will make things a whole lot easier in case something just dies or some bank goes nuts. And we've had a lot of that lately. This is all fired up and sent, you know, put together, moved the money, moved around, make sure everything works. And then it is all put in the box and shipped out to the client. And when the client opens up the box, a magical thing that happens. They are now empowered to carry on business worldwide and income tax free. How does that sound? So once the person opens up a box and, you know, say they sell some kind of widget or they provide some kind of service or whatever, that's typically what's known as a small business, as in what we know in society, not what the IRS defines as small business. You know, it's rather simple. So, but that simple business can be grown to huge effect. I believe Dalmer Chrysler, and you should know those names, is an LLC, and it is huge. So the basis of this is great. It's private. They're on the public record. There can be no connection to the client whatsoever. And all our people are without the jurisdiction of the IRS, so they don't care. And then, and it can be grown, okay? So now we can also hook several of these together to accomplish what's called judgment proof. All right. So a judgment is what happens if you get sued or your company gets sued or whatever, and the suit is successful, then the court will issue a judgment that you pay $100,000 or whatever it may be. All right. Once the judgment is issued by the court, it is the plaintiff's responsibility to enforce them. Okay. The judge says, yeah, go for it. But he gives you authority, but he doesn't give you any backup. So we'll talk about how we hook these together. So we'll say, and I like to use the one that I learned a long time ago. It's called a dentist office. A dentist, which is a doctor of dentistry, practices dentistry. So he has a practice. Now we would take one LLC and they would be the practice owner, and that would situate that. Now the dentist needs several pieces of equipment, and like the chairs and the drills and so forth and so on. Okay. So those cost money and they're separate items. So we have a second LLC to own all the equipment and rent it to the practice. Then normally the dentist needs to do this in a building. And so we can have a third LLC that owns the building and rents that back to the practice. So then you usually have people working in the dentist office other than the dentist, like, you know, receptionist and hygienist and so forth. And so they would work for and not employ, because that's a defined term, remember? You know, the full-time life insurance salesman. So not an employee, but a worker for the LLC. And so the three or four assistants in the practice would be working under this LLC, and they would translate their, or they would contract their services to the practice. And then the dentist himself, you know, he's probably got a house and stuff, so he can have another LLC that owns his house. It's titled in the LLC's name. And so if the practice were to be sued, the doctor himself normally carries malpractice insurance, and so that would get that. And if the judgment is against the practice and not the doctor specifically, then all the only thing that the plaintiff could get would be what was in the practice's checking account, which would be very limited by that time. And then, but he couldn't get the equipment, and he couldn't get the building, and he couldn't get anything to do with the workers because they're all titled and or operated under other LLCs and they rent back to the practice. All right. So that's quick and dirty on how we can really become judgment proof by using several of these LLCs. Another great thing is called estate planning. So in the typical way, mom and pop own their house and their car and their boat. And they've got Johnny and Sally as two little kids. And then the kids grow up and mom and pop pass away. And whether they have a will or not, then typically you get a probate. And then a judge settles on all this stuff and pays off any debts and so forth and so on and assigns the taxes to this, right? That's known as estate taxes. So if mom and pop move the title of their house, car, and boat, their estate, and their assets under an LLC umbrella, so it is entitled in that name, and then they hand off the letters of authority, aka commissions as managers, and to each of the beneficiaries, the kids or now who are now adults. And so if mom and pop pass away or become incapacitated to a lesser level, then you know, they've already told that the kids that, yeah, your letter of authority for this and all the books are here, and this is the instructions of how we'd like the business carried on in our absence. And they just open those up and make the proper connections with the bank accounts and so forth. And the business goes on because these businesses, these LLCs, are set up in perpetuity, which means forever. And that they stay in good standing. And that is the quote, in good standing, end quote, is the term the governments use to make sure that how you determine if a business is alive and viable and operating. So that's three quick things that these LLCs can do. And we call our limited liability companies products a private firm, because that comes from the Supreme Court case Flint v. Stone Tracy, in which the Supreme Court said that a private firm is not subject to the income tax. And that's where you want to be. Not subject to, aka not liable for, aka immune. Not exempt, but immune. What are your questions?
Well, my first question is going to be, if litigation ensues, may one of the team players here at your Remedies in the Law, may they be brought in to a position where they may defend the LLC, unlike an attorney, a member of the bar?
I can't answer that question. I would say that there's some guys on your crew that really understand the legal system and know how to do it. So I would say yes, because the quote unquote registered owner. Because when these articles of organization are filled out, the organizer is considered to be the owner if nothing else is ever filed on the New Mexico public record.
Mm-hmm.
So that shows that an LLC owns the LLC, and so forth. And the LLC obviously can't show up in court. It has to have a manager or something like that. And so, I guess I'll let you legal guys fill that out. Figure that out.
Okay. We're going to bring that up. I'd like to have a conversation with you and John sometime in the next week or 10 days to see if we can't nail that down for certainty, because that would be a definite asset to
I have a really high 90% thing that anybody could represent the limited liability company if litigation did ensue.
Good. Excellent. Thank you. All right. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. Those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center of your monitor, to the right of the center of your monitor. You'll see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click into that rectangle. Type away your comment or your question. And then underneath, you'll see a place where you may put your name and some other information if you like. It'll help us out. And then hit submit. When you pop the submit key on my end, I get to see your question. And I'll be happy to give voice to your comment or question as soon as it pops up. So, again, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. We don't want to have a short call tonight. What we do want to have is some good questions. So go ahead, press star 2, and let's see what happens. I'm going to go check Freedoms Radio while you're working up the nerve. Well, some people are shy. All right, refreshing over at Freedoms, nothing there. Mr. Slevin, nobody has raised their hands.
Okay, well, while we're thinking about this, a third-party member who's typically on the call came up with, he had heard something about, concerning the charitable religious trust. And one of the information providers, and I'm not sure who exactly when this is, but anyway, they talked about section, I believe it was 6603 in the Internal Revenue Code, which addresses exempt organizations. And that's why I wanted to make that comment clear, that the limited liability company is not exempt, because the word exempt in law means that you meet the criteria, but in their largesse, the legislators exempt you from the penalty. Right. So that's why we use the word immune. Immune means you do not meet the criteria and never will. So immune means not liable for ever and not subject to ever. And so we wanted to make those distinctions between the trusts, which are typically listed as exempt, and the limited liability company, which is in fact immune. Go ahead.
Understood. Thank you. That's a good point. So anyone, raise your hands. Otherwise, we're going to say goodnight real early, and that's not fun. It's not fun at all. Mr. Slevin might get his feelings hurt.
Not
at all. You don't have to buy him a cold beer.
Yeah, well, okay. I'll.
Have you bitten your lower lip yet, Mr. Slevin?
No, I didn't really bite it, but I just, yeah, I can deal with that.
All right. Miss Jennifer Sue, thank you very much. Jennifer?
Unmute the phone.
Sorry. My phone wouldn't listen to my finger that was pushing on it. So I thought now that corporations sole and the charitable religious trust were an exception, not an exemption. And an exception is kind of like immunity, where you're just not part of the whole system.
That's correct.
But they're not really an exemption. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely correct. It's an exception. And what I encourage people to do when they operate through Mr. Slevin's LLC is to actually operate through two CRTs as 50% owners to each, so that when the business grows to a point where it can afford what's called the golden horseshoe, it can just dovetail right in. And so you've had the opportunity for the months that you've needed to, or possibly years that you've needed to, operating through Mr. Slevin's LLC, your commercial application, but then to dovetail it into the Golden Horseshoe, and I'm all about adding layers and layers, and you could not envelop me in enough Kevlar to make me happy. So if there's another piece of half-inch steel I can stand behind, I'm standing behind it. It's the more barrier I can put between me and what's coming against me or what may come against me, the more comfortable I am about it. So Mr. Slevin's LLC is one additional layer of protection and for immediate use, and then its application within the Golden Horseshoe are even more applications.
If I may comment on that, too, the
sure.
If you were to walk into a bank, say, and say, I'd like to get a checking account for my trust, the typical banker wouldn't really know how to do that or if it could be done because they don't deal with trust. And there's been a lot of misinformation out there. However, in the banking world, aka the business world, everybody knows what an LLC is and they deal with them all the time. As I said, Daimler Chrysler is one of the largest in the world. So we've taken to calling our LLCs a commercial interface for the client and or their trusts and whichever way they would prefer to use that kind of protection. Just wanted to bring that up.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. All right. Jennifer, any other comments or questions?
Well, no, I just wanted to distinguish between exception and exemption because they're not the
only one made.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to have a very early night tonight, and that's not going to upset me. But you're missing a great opportunity to ask your questions. Otherwise, let's check Freedoms Radio one more time, and we'll bring a close to it. Refresh, that's it. All right, Mr. Slevin, any closing comments?
Hey, have a great day.
You too. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.